Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of September. For the past many Tuesdays, we've been talking about healthcare during our 10 o'clock hours. We've looked at healthcare in countries all over the world. And this hour, this is going to be a fascinating discussion. We're going to look at healthcare in this country through the eyes of presidents from 1933 until 2009. The co-author of a marvelous book on healthcare, health and politics in the Oval Office, The Heart of Power is the name of the book, is with us. And our guest is the professor and chair of political science at Brown University. His name is Professor James Marone. He is also the author of Hellfire Nation, The Politics of Morality in American History, and The Democratic Wish, Popular Participation in the Limits of American Government. He's testified before Congress many times, was a member of Governor Mario Cuomo's Task Force on Universal Health Care for All New Yorkers, and he's taught at many other schools, including the University of Chicago and Yale. And I like this best about his resume. The Brown University classes of many years have voted him the teacher who most inspired them. The Heart of Power, this hour of the program. Every president, the authors write from FDR, who took office in 1933, to George W. Bush, who stepped down in 2009, has grappled with it. Some presidents seize health care and others try to shun it, but willy-nilly, it rises up every president's agenda. Well, welcome phone calls for Professor Marone. Our number is 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk at WPR.org. Professor James Marone, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Great to be with you.
And thanks for the book. It is just so well done.
Oh, it's a lot of fun to do. Presidents are interesting guys, and we got into it. We have our favorites and the ones we were hissing and booing and so forth. Very unexpected as we went into each one's background.
Yeah. You say, and how true this is of this particular issue, that healthcare tests presidents' ideas, heart, luck, allies, and their skill at running the most complicated government machinery in the world. It tests all of that.
Yeah, it really does. You know, the current outrage, the outcry, the screaming around this health issue, around this Obama health plan, is nothing new. It happens every time. Presidents sort of march into this. Some are very perceptive. Franklin Roosevelt refused to bring this. His advisors begged him that they just wanted national health insurance. They had just won Social Security. They were sure they could win it. And Roosevelt counted up the votes in Congress, and he refused to go. You know, one of the most powerful presidents in the 20th century, perhaps in all American history, and he's one who ducked because he understood that this was such a difficult issue. So each president either marches into health reform or ducks it, but no matter what happens, it is an intense issue, and so it really tests the presidents like no other issue does.
You would have thought that FDR would have taken this on because of his own extraordinary difficulties with his health.
You know, that's what we thought going into it. We thought he'd be particularly sympathetic because not only did he contract polio, but the physicians who attended him did a horrible job. The first one said, it's a cold, don't worry about it, and went home. And then they found a famous physician who they brought up to his resort in Maine, where he used to spend the summers. And this guy not only misdiagnosed him, but sent him a bill for $6,000.
Oh,
that
my
would
gosh.
Be about the equivalent today of $80,000 for a misdiagnosis. And then when FDR, by sheer grit, began to create a recovery program that he himself designed and got himself back on his feet, physicians were very dismissive. No, you'll never walk again, they said. Oh, your exercises are useless. And they were wrong. He was right, and they were wrong. He was a better doctor to himself than the doctors that were around him. We thought, with that background, FDR would really want to, you know, push this. But he didn't. He constantly deferred to physicians he knew, and when his staff really pushed, he used to look at the head of the congressional committees, who were conservative Southern Democrats, and he'd say, I can't get it past those guys. So until the end of his life, now Kathleen, the most interesting thing we found about FDR, after all that, is in 1944, the war is now ending, and it's clear the Allies are going to win. And after the war, FDR and his advisors believe, here's the man, he's the man who will be larger than life, because he's brought America through Depression and now triumphantly through World War II, and they begin to cast around for a domestic issue that they can seize on when the war is over and things return to normal. And then in 43, 44, Roosevelt begins to say NHI, National Health Insurance. In fact, he gets very annoyed at the English, who pass National Health Service, a national health system for England, and they use the phrase cradle-to-grave health care. And Roosevelt used to complain, that's my phrase. They stole my phrase. And he had a sense he was going to steal it back and ride his triumph during World War II, into national health insurance. Hmm. He died 3 months, April, 3 months before victory over Japan, in April of 1945. And the plan that he wrote and the blueprint for getting it through Congress passed to a completely untried President Harry Truman, who then made it the great cause of his life.
Isn't that something? And Harry Truman was a guy, you tell stories about Harry Truman who built a hospital for people who were sick. Harry Truman, who had this really good heart when it came to health care for all people, right? He didn't care if they were destitute. He didn't care if they didn't have any ambition. He just had a feel for human beings.
Yes, that's right. Harry Truman made health care, who was possibly our healthiest president, by the way, made health care his great cause. He came up in this very corrupt Missouri political machine. But he was the one completely squeaky clean guy in that machine, and they were shocked. He said, okay, I'm going to build a hospital because, you know, the poor people in our county, they can't get care.
Yeah.
And the machine bosses were, you're never going to get the voters to pay taxes for a hospital. And Harry said, if you let me campaign for it, I'm going to make it happen. Now, these were guys that were used to just being, you know, corrupt machine politicians. But when they saw Harry built this hospital, they were amazed. And he was efficient, he was clean, but he had this huge heart. He'd say, if a guy doesn't have any ambition and is lazy, you know, he's going to be poor, but we still have to take care of him. And we still have to take care of his family when it comes to sickness. He just believed that in a modern society, everybody had to get health care. So he proposed national health insurance twice, and during the famous 1948 electoral campaign, the one where everybody expected Truman to lose, his famous Chicago Tribune headline, Dewey
sure.
defeats Truman. Truman's big issue in that campaign was national health insurance. His last speech was about, right before the polls closed, was national health insurance.
And then Lyndon Johnson, when he signs Medicare, invites Harry Truman to the signing. I recently saw a clip of that on television. What a moving thing.
That was so touching. Johnson gets, and that's a whole story I'm sure we'll get into.
Yeah.
Johnson wins Medicare, and the first thing he says is, I want Harry to have the first card. And some of his advisors say, well, you know, Truman got nowhere, and he was tarred with the socialized medicine brush. And that was during the Red Scares, when it was really, those were really fighting words back then, worse than now. And Johnson said, I don't care. We're going out to Independence, Missouri. 81-year-old Harry Truman is going to watch me sign this bill. It's very touching. Johnson turns to Truman and says, only you, Mr. President, only you can understand what I'm feeling today. These two great liberal icons. And if you're a true blue Wisconsin liberal, that is the high point of your history. This, you know, Lyndon Johnson, the great liberal reformer, before he gets trapped in Vietnam, turns to Harry Truman, the great liberal lion, and the two of them look at one another. And Harry responds, this is the happiest moment of my life. As Lyndon Johnson signs Medicare, which was about a piece of Harry Truman's national health insurance. I should say that in going back to the very last year of Truman's administration, that would be 1952, his advisors came in and said, Mr. President, you're never going to get national health insurance through. You just can't get it through Congress. How about if we just give it to the old folks, people over 65? And Harry agreed to that in 1952. That became eventually Medicare, and between 1952 and 1965, liberal Democrats pushed and struggled and fought for this bill, Medicare, which finally passes in 65.
Hmm. And you talk about, let's move to Johnson here for a moment, because Johnson gave valuable advice, and I'm wondering if President Obama is listening to that advice with his speech tomorrow night, that he didn't want to get bogged down in the details because, and it's even worse now, economists would project how much all of this is going to cost into the future, and people would say, oh my gosh, we can't afford this. So Johnson just hammered on the big vision.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Johnson is the most interesting character. We discovered a bunch of telephone tapes that had just been released, so we could actually hear him talking. And there's a number of very important lessons. The first is Johnson wins this huge landslide, and it's the second largest landslide after Roosevelt for any Democrat in history. And he gathers his staff around him the next day, and he says, okay, every day I'm going to lose power. Every day someone's going to get angry at me. You've got to move fast. Since Medicare was his first priority, he said you've got to push it really fast before anybody gets, before I lose my power. And he was right. He did lose his power. So he moved very quickly. Secondly, he was a master at playing behind the scenes with Congress. So the old story of Medicare was that Wilbur Mills, the famous head of the Ways and Means Committee from Arkansas, a representative from Arkansas, at the last minute takes the Medicare bill, which by now only pays for the hospital costs for people over 65. He looks at a Republican, John Byrne, and he says, your bill, which is a bill that was introduced as an alternative, which would pay for the doctor's costs of people over 65. I like your bill, too, he says. And there's another Republican bill which would just pay for poor people. Well, those, and he said, I like them all. Let's put them all together. So he took three alternative bills, the administration bill, a Republican bill to pay doctor's visits, and another Republican bill to pay for poor people, and he single-handedly made Medicare Part A for hospitals, what we now call Medicare Part B for doctor's offices, and Medicaid. And he said, I'm going to pass all three. Johnson and his advisors go running to him and say, my God, Wilbur Mills has just tripled the size of the program. What do we do? And LBJ says, let him do it. I'll find the money somewhere. What we now know from these tapes is that Johnson was in on this coup. He started bugging Mills a year earlier. He kept saying, and Wilbur Mills would say, wait a minute, I've opposed this. I can't be for it now. And Johnson would say, tell him it wasn't big enough. Make it bigger, Wilbur. If you make it bigger, everybody will congratulate you. They might even make you vice president, Wilbur. Wilbur, you'll be the hero. No one will know I knew anything about it. And it's true, for 40 years, no one got any credit for this but Wilbur Mills. Ask any historian, and they'll tell you, oh, yeah, that was Wilbur Mills that made Medicare. And now we know Johnson did it behind the scenes, but never let on. He even lies about it in his autobiography. He says it's all Wilbur Mills. Well, we know from the telephone tapes it wasn't all Wilbur Mills. So Johnson worked with Congress, and really, he seemed to put ideas in Wilbur Mills' head. And he kept, you know, one time Wilbur Mills is walking onto the floor of Congress on some, and Johnson's on the phone to one of his aides, and the aide goes, oh, there goes Wilbur. Johnson goes, put him on. And he starts banging him about, well, how's the Mills bill coming? So the second lesson for Obama is work, and this is a big one right now, work behind the scenes. Make these guys think they're going to get all the credit, because all you care about is a good bill. And he'd always say, but I'm not going to get into the details. You do the details, I'll do the big picture. And that's how Johnson did it. Mm-hmm. And then one third lesson, and this is a doozy. People hate it when I say this. I'm sure you'll get some calls about this, Kathleen. But Johnson suppressed the cost data. So we didn't have an office of management and budget. We didn't have a congressional budget office. None of these offices existed then. And we've got this one wonderful tape where he's talking to a newly elected senator from Massachusetts named Ted Kennedy. So completely green behind the ears. And Ted is asking him, how do I pass health legislation? And Johnson says, don't let the economists get their hands on the numbers. With Medicare, they started projecting that thing 5 years down the road. And they're saying it's going to cost $1 billion. Now, I don't care if it costs $1 billion. Old people need health care. Don't let the economists get you all wrapped up. So he actually suppressed the cost numbers. So if you love Medicare, you have this this conundrum to puzzle about. If we had had accurate cost data for Medicare, we would have never had Medicare.
That's fascinating. But
so
it's also
the other lesson.
But the other lesson, too, from him is that his big things were healthcare and education. And didn't he say to Hubert Humphrey, I think,
yes,
you know, I'll spend whatever. If it's $1 billion, I'll spend whatever. These are my issues. I don't care how much it costs.
So wonderful. He said, you know, I don't tell Lady Bird, his wife, I don't tell Lady Bird about whether she can buy coffee and sugar. You got to have coffee and sugar around the house. Well, health care and education is the same way. Americans got to have health care and education. I'm not going to ask how much it costs any more than I'm going to ask Lady Bird about coffee and sugar. And that was his real passion. It's a great tragedy, Kathleen, that he got so wrapped up in this Vietnam War.
Yes.
Because the Lyndon Johnson of the first 2 years with the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the war on poverty, the Medicare and Medicaid, this was a lion. He would have been, just from those first couple of years, remembered, memorialized as an amazing president, as the greatest liberal president in history, if he hadn't gotten all tangled up in Vietnam. And he knew from, we can see this, that he was in over his head in Vietnam, but he didn't know what to do, and he just kept marching forward.
Well, we're going to welcome phone calls. We have many other presidents to talk about during this hour. The author of a wonderful book on the history of healthcare in this country is co-author is with us this hour. The book is The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. And the authors have looked at, 75-year history. They've gone from FDR and, well, all of the presidents will ultimately have advice through their history, and they're dealing with this issue for the current president as he deals with health care reform. Professor James Marone is our guest. He is at Brown University. He's professor and chair of political science at Brown, the author of Hellfire Nation and The Democratic Wish, which was a New York Times notable book. And you can see why he's been voted time and again the teacher who most inspired his students at Brown University. All right, to your phone calls. I think we're probably going to get flooded here, so call early, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And one more reminder that tomorrow at 7, we will have live coverage of President Obama's primetime address to Congress. It has been much anticipated, as you know, and he knows how to give a speech. The question is, will he be specific enough about what it is he wants, and will he be inspirational enough to get and has done enough back behind the scenes maneuvering to be able to get significant health care reform in this country and soon. All right, that's all I have to say at the moment. To your calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Dr. Brian from Pewaukee. Hi.
Yes, good morning, Kathleen. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Hi, Dr. Brian. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I want to talk about a couple of things. First thing is Janet Travell and JFK and how she helped him with his intervertebral disc lesion. Are you familiar?
Oh, yes. This is a great story. You want to say a word about it, or should I take it from here?
Well, if there's potential, I'd like to just reference that Janet is one of my idols, heroes, because she introduced conservative management. And conservative management is where we're growing. We can't afford health care anymore. We can't afford medicine, I should say. We're paying way too much and getting very little for it. So, please, tell us the story of Janet Travell.
Okay. There's an important policy point you're making, but JFK, despite the impression he gave of vigor, is probably the sickest of American presidents. American presidents, as a rule, are sicker than average people. The stress and often bad medical care. Kennedy gets the last rites of the Catholic Church four times as an adult. So he is in constant pain. As a kid, he gets not very good medicine, and so he has a whole series of terrible diseases. And he also seeks not very good medical care, so that at one point he got this charlatan from New York, a celebrity doctor known as Dr. Feelgood, to inject into his spine five times a day a concoction to ease the pain in his spine.
Wow.
Although people like his brother, Robert, were really worried that this was going to have terrible long-term consequences, and they probably would have had he lived. Janet Travell becomes the White House physician, and she tries to impose some order on JFK's medical regimen, which is just chaos. He is taking 26, 30 different medications a day.
Oh, my
gosh. Try to stay vigorous. It's literally, when you look at the inventory of drugs he takes, it's remarkable. In fact, there's one great moment, the famous debate between Kennedy and Nixon in the 1960 election that's often credited with electing Kennedy. Kennedy had the flush of drugs in his face, essentially. Nixon, who looked sweaty and pale, had a temporary knee infection. He was actually a quite healthy guy, at least physically, not psychologically. He bangs his knee going into the studio and is in excruciating pain. So Kennedy, feeling no pain from his concoctions of drugs, and Nixon feeling great pain despite being the healthier man. Janet Travell tries to organize the White House, although she herself is pushed out by other physicians who come in and say she's being too lenient on Kennedy's drug use. So very interesting story. There's lots of details, but the essential story is Kennedy's terrible health. We expected that Kennedy's own ill health and his mistreatment at the hands of the medicine of the day would make him very sympathetic to Medicare. But it didn't make any difference to him at all. He was a tough guy. He was absolutely fearless about just suppressing his own aches and pains. And then his father, Joe Kennedy, had a stroke, and that devastated him. After his father's stroke, he couldn't stop talking to his aides about health for elderly Americans. He kept saying, how do normal people do it? It'd get into his speeches. He made it his number one issue, and it was his father's health that made Kennedy a great proponent of passing Medicare. Even though he never did, his assassination passed and both an issue and a martyr's cause into Lyndon Johnson's hands.
Interesting. And you tell this story of his being at Madison Square Garden the night after Marilyn Monroe sang to him that infamous night.
Yeah, the infamous happy birthday.
Yeah, right.
Marilyn Monroe. He goes to see his dad, and then he gives a speech which was not a very good speech. He had 18,000 people screaming and yelling at Madison Square Garden, and he got a little carried away. It was too hot and rambling. But we think this great, charismatic president who really could give a speech like Obama, this issue was cutting too close to him, and he was departing from his text, talking about his dad. He stops at one point in the middle of the speech and says, I don't know how people can afford this. My old man's rich, but how can they afford it? And then he just stops, and he says, it's hard. Mm. It's hard. And you can really feel how it's touching him.
Yeah. And so did Teddy get his fervor for the issue from the same incident, the same family incident with his father?
You know, that's a great question. We didn't study Teddy Kennedy, but he is there in every single chapter. He seems to get the issue. We think he got the issue from John himself. Mm. So John got it from his father. This is one of his great unfinished victories, and Teddy picks it up. And our hunch is that it really starts with John. But Teddy, over the years, feels incredibly intense about this issue, and you can see him becoming more and more forceful and self-confident in it. that he divides the Democratic Party in 1978 specifically over the health care issue. He thought Jimmy Carter, who was president, was going too slow. And really the end of the Democratic era, which starts in 1930 with Democrats taking over Congress from the Republicans, and really ends, I think, in 1978 when Carter and Kennedy square off over NHI, though, of course, Reagan comes in the following election, and from then on, it's really been much more of a Republican-leaning government than a Democratic-leaning government. That's the last moment, the last great debate within the Democratic Party. You know, Dr. Bryant says one other thing that I want to comment on very briefly,
sure.
And that is about the cost of health care. The reason this issue is never going to go away until we do something, he's absolutely right. Think of it this way. Every year, every 4 years, we take a penny out of every dollar we spend and we send it to the healthcare system. So an extra 1% of GDP, of our total economy, goes to healthcare every 4 or 5 years. Around the rest of the world, everybody's screaming about healthcare costs, but in most wealthy nations, it's roughly speaking flat. That is, the percentage of the economy going to healthcare doesn't change. With us, it grows a little bit it grows a lot every year. So every 4 years, imagine that, we're spending an extra percentage of the economy. There are some wise guy economists, like Uwe Reinhardt at Princeton, who like to make projections about when we'll have it all, 100% of the economy going to healthcare, a wall-to-wall hospital, no more radio. It's not going to get to that. So sooner or later, we're going to have to stop the endless rise of healthcare, not only to individuals and to governments, but for the economy as a whole. We can't keep shifting our costs just to healthcare. So we're spending a little less on everything else and a little more on healthcare every year. And that's why the issue won't go away.
Right.
Until we resolve that, it's going to stay.
Is it in your book, you call it the largest American industry.
It is. There's no question. 16.2% of the American economy. Nothing comes close. So it's, there's more people in hospital beds than it's just a huge industry.
Right.
And that, that's part of the problem. Everybody talks about healthcare costs, but of course, all that money is actually going to doctors and nurses and hospitals and insurance companies and administrators and so forth.
Yeah.
So that's the money we spend is actually going to people who'd rather not give it up.
Yeah. Thanks, Dr. Bryan, for your call. Bill from Madison is next. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Bill.
Hi. I just wanted your comment on the attempts to skewer the health care plan that Obama is proposing for the public option as socialist. My comment on it would just be that if it's good enough for Goldman Sachs and AIG, then it's good enough for me. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. This has been the cry since 1948 when Harry Truman suggested his bill. And remember, that's in the middle of the Red Scare. He actually says in his speech, this is not socialism. And the Republicans in Congress essentially say, yes, it is. The minority leader, Robert Taft of Ohio, says this is the most socialistic measure ever before Congress. And the president's friends have to take out full-page ads in the New York Times and the Washington Post saying this is not socialism. Not a very strong argument for national health insurance, it has to be said, being that negative. The reason it gets, and it always goes this way, it always gets this intense. And it's really interesting why it gets this intense. For one thing, there's a genuine philosophical difference between the parties. Democrats are shamed that we have no national health insurance. To them, they report by the National Academy of Sciences that 18,000 Americans die every year for inadequate health insurance is a shame. It's a blot on America. Republicans are proud of the fact that here's one place where we're actually different from Sweden and Norway and Canada and Britain. We have no national health insurance, and that's a mark of distinction. To go down a little deeper, there's very few areas where Democrats genuinely deeply distrust free markets. And Republicans genuinely, deeply distrust government. Usually there's something in between. This time there's that genuine difference. Now, that difference exists no matter what. But then there's a second difference. Look, let's not kid around. This is a battle for control of Washington. If Obama wins a serious health plan, he is bigger than life. He's done what most presidents couldn't do. So he becomes very powerful. If he loses this, his administration is crippled. Everybody in Washington knows what this fight is about. So with the stakes this high, people are using every argument they can make. Though it has to be said, the Republicans have fought this, as they usually do, with an intensity that Democrats simply haven't matched. Democrats march into health reform thinking, well, look, this is a good reform. It makes sense. We'll argue about a policy. Republicans argue about the nature of America. And arguing for a policy never beats arguing about the nature of America. So that's really what Obama has to try to reset in the debate tomorrow night. Big job.
Is he a little Johnny-come-lately on this?
The Democrats always are. You know, no one ever expects the ferocity of the debate. And it's very hard if you're bogged down by specific, boring policy details to come out against these really quite marvelous and shrewd concoctions like throw granny off the bus.
Right.
So there's a sort of fearfulness that's very difficult to match.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that there's a couple of things that people aren't saying that are being missed in this debate, and it's really worth getting on the table. One, the Republicans are taking an incredible risk. Imagine that the Democrats pass something, okay, big if, and another big if, that it's popular. The
right.
Republicans have really exposed their flank in a way historically they've never done before. So if this becomes a popular program, say a Medicare, what are Republicans going to do for cover? Essentially, everybody in the House is going to have a hard time on the Republican side moving up to higher office if this becomes a popular program.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, say in the battle for Medicare, only 10 Republicans in the House voted for Medicare when it came up. In the battle for Social Security back in 1935, one House Republican voted for it. But after it was clear it was going to go down, it was going to go up, Social Security in 35, Medicare in 65, most of the House Republicans turned around and switched their votes. So they could say, well, you know, we supported it. And it was sort of hard to tag them with being opponents because at the end of the day, they supported the bill. And they both passed by what appeared to be large bipartisan margins. The Republicans this time have painted themselves into a corner that says if they can defeat this or water it down so much that it's not much of a program, they will be hugely victorious. So the momentum will swing back in their direction, and they'll probably really rack up big victories in the midterm. So, okay for that. But they're really, all the chips are on the table. If they lose this and it becomes popular, no Democrat is going to run for any office without turning to the Republicans and saying, without you, we would not have our good health care system.
Yeah,
so there's a lot at stake for the Republicans as well that people aren't talking about.
Yeah, big issue. Before we go back to phone calls, I want to spend some time talking about the ever-complicated Richard Nixon, who I didn't realize until reading your book that he suffered enormous tragedy with his brothers dying when they were very young. The first Republican president, you write, to accept the premise all Americans should have health insurance, but ridiculing the liberal folly of wrecking the entire private insurance system to cover the minority of Americans who lived without insurance. So he really is kind of the father of this plan, isn't he, that we have now, which is public and private.
Exactly. Nixon is the first president after Medicare passes. Johnson passes Medicare. Nixon replaces Johnson. So everybody's asking, oh, my God, here's a Republican and a guy who's been very conservative throughout his career. What's he going to do to Medicare? And to everybody's amazement, Nixon proves to be a very innovative president when it comes to health care issues. The central Democratic proposal, again, sponsored by Ted Kennedy, was essentially what we would today call Medicare for All. Look, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, we got, back in the Nixon administration, we got Medicare for people over 65. Now let's expand Medicare to everybody. So that was the Democratic proposal. Nixon said, that's nuts. You don't want to rewrite the whole health care system. Lots of people have private health insurance. Let them keep it. Let's have a system where everybody's covered, but it's a mixed system. So Nixon is the father of almost all the future health reforms, and he almost got it through. Here's one of the great stories. Nixon's aides got together with Kennedy and Wilbur Mills, the same Wilbur Mills who passed Medicare, and the three of them met. The aides would meet every all the time, and then the Kennedy, Mills, and someone from the Nixon White House, Stuart Altman, would meet once a week. And they, the three of them, the great liberal Kennedy, the great conservative Nixon, Wilbur Mills in the middle, hashed out a national health insurance program. Wilbur Mills takes it to the Ways and Means Committee in 1974, March of 74, just before August of 74 is when Nixon goes down. So the Watergate is blazing, and they have a vote, and it passes through the Ways and Means Committee, National Health Insurance does, for the first time, but only by one vote. The Republicans look at Wilbur and say, are you kidding me? And Wilbur Mills is saying, this is their president's program. And they say, are you kidding me? We're not going to go for national health insurance. Passes by one vote, that's not enough. And that was the last sort of wave of national health insurance for a long time, till the 90s. But Nixon is really the father of the Clinton plan and the Obama plan.
I wonder if the president will say that tomorrow night.
I don't think so. That's a secret.
That's
and you shouldn't tell people that because it'll get everybody up in arms. So let's just keep that between ourselves.
Right. Okay. We'll do that. Let's go to Robert from Stevens Point. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Robert.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for that. Explaining about Nixon's stand on health care. You kind of answered the question before I could ask
it. Oh, great. I love it when that happens, Robert.
Yeah, but maybe on the subject of Nixon, you mentioned that Nixon was physically as opposed to psychologically healthy, but didn't he have a problem with phlebitis?
Yes, he did. That's right. You're absolutely right. Let's talk for a second about Nixon's health in general. When Nixon was a young boy, one of his brothers dies, and it deeply affects him. And then his favorite brother, his oldest brother, dies of tuberculosis. We think because the family kept a cow, and you can get tuberculosis from tainted milk. His father was a crusty old guy, would not let the cow be tested. His beloved older brother gets it. Really helps to write a book with a physician. My co-author is a physician, so he was explaining all this stuff as we went along. His favorite older brother, everybody's favorite, Harold, gets TB, and his mother goes off for 4 years to Arizona. They can't afford a sanitarium, so she takes in other boys with TB and nurses them. And they all die. All the boys she took in. She takes them in for the rent money. And then Richard's brother dies as well. There's a famous scene in which, described by Richard's mother in an article, in which his father, who was an abusive SOB, is weeping like a baby. He's just lost a second son. And Richard just sits there, dry-eyed, staring off into space. He believed he had to now be as good as three boys for his parents. This deeply, deeply affected him. So if you look at any speech when Nixon is really under pressure, like his final speech to his White House staff, what comes gurgling out is this description of his mother, a saint. In fact, she's not really a saint. She's pretty cold. But as he describes her as a saint caring for these kids who would all die. So to him, this deeply affected him, and all his life, Richard Nixon, even when he's a red-baiting, right-wing congressman from California, all his life, he's a real liberal by Republican standards and by Republican standards on health care.
Interesting.
And it really deeply scars him psychologically. This was a hurting man.
Yes.
So that there's this great scene that plays out over and over again. Richard Nixon sneaks out of the White House, is across the street in a hideaway office. The fireplace is blazing. The air conditioner is going full blast. Richard does not permit anybody but four aides to talk to him. So he's completely cut off. And he writes on yellow pads, page after page, of brilliant, crazy stuff. I'm going to end the Cold War by going to China. I've gone to China. The Russians are reeling. I'm going to go to Russia and pursue a policy of what the French called the détente. I'm going to get national health insurance. He just had the stuff of genius, but at the same time, he would be dead drunk at night. during the Yom Kippur War in 1973, the British Prime Minister calls Nixon about what they're going to do in the middle of this terrible war. They're worried that the Russians are going to come in and create World War III. Nixon's too drunk to take the phone call, and his staff has to block it. So genius, yes, reasonably healthy, but towards the end of his life, partially because he abuses alcohol so terribly, he gets into all kinds of health troubles, phlebitis, as you say. But for most of his life, he's relatively healthy, except psychologically, where he is a tormented, really somewhat twisted genius. We walked away from Nixon far more respectful of the man after we had read his own notes to himself, and really a little sympathetic to this poor, poor guy. He really suffered in his life.
We're talking with the co-author of The Heart of Power this hour of the program, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. Professor James Marone is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And what this book does, it looks at how presidents have dealt with the issue of health care and health reform. And they say presidents repeatedly change the way we think and talk about what has become America's largest industry. So it goes back to FDR and takes us all the way through. And you can't help but talk about the Obama administration as they face this issue in a huge way. They have been, and tomorrow is a huge night for where they go with health care reform. All right. To your phone calls, more of them in a moment. Thanks very much, Robert, for your call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two reminders. Tomorrow night at 7, we will be covering President Barack Obama's speech before the joint session of Congress on health care reform. A reminder, actually, this is filled, but we're doing a health care forum at Frederick Hospital a week from tomorrow, it is, with all kinds of people. We'll have a panel of eight. We invited listeners, but I got filled in a hurry. There's a lot of interest in this, so we invite you to stay tuned for our forum. I mean, tuned in on the radio a week from tomorrow from 9 to 11. Back to phone calls. Clyde is our next caller from Grafton. Hi, Clyde.
Hi. Hi. Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you very much for this series that you've been putting on for all of Wisconsin and for other people who can pick up your broadcast about the healthcare crisis. It's extremely valuable, and thank you again for that.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Professor Moran, for his and a digression into history and into politics and politicians.
Yeah, thanks, Clyde.
It's and their relationship. It is important for us to know history. One thing I think I'd like to contribute is, I haven't had time to verify this because I've been working on the issue itself and on connecting with the issue and the people. But I understand that the Bull Moose Party and Teddy Roosevelt, 100 years ago, were the first politicians for national office that advocated and had their prime platform plank. One of them was for a national health system, and I also understand that another plank that the Bull Moose Party had was to end the legalized bribery of campaign contributions by a system of public financing of elections, instead of allowing corporations and very wealthy individuals to basically buy both major parties and their officials.
Yeah, Clyde, that's a great point, and it's true. You're absolutely right. The Bull Moose Party ran in 1912. Roosevelt steps down in 1908. His hand selected successor is William Howard Taft. He's president from 1908 to 1912. 1913, and Roosevelt doesn't think Taft's doing nearly as good a job. Roosevelt, as you suggest, was a real Republican progressive reformer. Really, the great progressive movement that comes out of the upper Midwest, out of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Roosevelt is absolutely bitten by that bug. And after 4 years out of office, he really takes on the cause. He puts together the Bull Moose Party for the 1912 election. This is an election with Taft running for re-election, Roosevelt running, and Woodrow Wilson running. The Republicans split, and Woodrow Wilson wins. That's why the one Democrat between Grover Cleveland and Franklin Roosevelt. And, yes, he puts national health insurance on the agenda for the first time. And it's interesting that it should be 1912. a professor at Harvard decides, and people think it was a pretty good decision, that 1912 is the great divide of American medicine. That is, the random patient going to the random doctor is more likely to be helped than harmed by the encounter with medicine starting in 1912. So that very first year when medicine is actually more likely to help you, the Bull Moose Party puts it on the agenda. Very briefly, the progressive reformers take this up as their great cause. And in 1915, two states actually, even though the Bull Moose Party goes down to defeat, two states actually try state national health insurance, California and New York. This is a huge debate. It dominates America, along with two other issues, whether we should enter World War I and whether we should have prohibition of alcohol. Huh. The other two were yes. And the American Medical Association supports national health insurance as it goes up before the New York and California legislatures. And then the AMA has this coup. They fire their board, and they vigorously oppose national health insurance. It goes down to defeat in California, goes down to defeat in New York, and the American Medical Association develops a reputation as ferocious opponents of health care. And indeed, they oppose every health care reform till this one. But you're absolutely right. That is the deep history of health care reform, too far back for us to go in our book. But that's an interesting story.
Let's talk a few moments. We're almost out of time here about Ronald Reagan. We can't neglect him. He was president for a long time, and we were seeing a different kind of philosophy here of the power of individuals to take risks in an open market, which I think that's fair. Correct me if it isn't his governing philosophy.
Ronald Reagan comes in and really transforms the government. In his inaugural address, he says government is not the solution. Government is the problem. He sees himself as the anti-Roosevelt. And he really redesigns American, not just government, but American thinking. So there was a sense that markets had limits before Ronald Reagan. And for Ronald Reagan really changed that, full of scorn for the idea that that underprivilege made people do bad things, full of scorn for the idea, as Obama said to Joe the plumber, that things are better when we spread the wealth. No, 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 individualism. The great irony is that Reagan, who had fought bitterly against Medicare, cut a record against Medicare, saying, we'll tell our children's children what it was like in America when men were free Medicare passes, he actually supported because he was tar. This was the one area where he noticed the current Republicans, where he was suspect because he had opposed Medicare. He actually pushed through what at the time was the largest expansion to Medicare over the advice of all of his advisors. That is the catastrophic health proposal. It didn't work. It was a terrible plan. But Reagan actually, on health care, became kind of a liberal late in his life. It was the one area where that was true. And we believe it was in part because he had so much to get out from under because of his very outspoken opposition to Medicare, which by this time was America's second favorite program after Social Security. Hmm. If we're running out of time, let me just make...
Oh, we have we have 3 minutes.
Oh, great.
That's a lifetime.
Oh, great. Two quick points,
yes.
Kathleen, or do you want to take another phone call?
Of course, I want to hear the points now.
Okay. If you look at the past, there are two lessons, one happy, one sad for Barack Obama. One is what the savvy political scientists and historians are always looking at the great public debate, but what they always say is you got to look at the inside game, like Johnson did. You got to look at what's going on in the halls of Congress. And right now, the real test for Obama, I hate to say this, is not so much the speech tomorrow, but the reverberations of the speech tomorrow in Congress. The Democrats have the votes if they have the heart to stick together, they can actually get a plan. So Obama's greatest test, judging by history, is not rallying the nation, though that's important. It's twisting arms and cracking heads in Congress. And that's probably when the history's written. Can he move his own people in Congress? That's where it's all going to come out in the wash. So watch carefully for the insider game over the next 3 weeks, as well as the speech. And one other great lesson, it's a lesson that Clinton gave us in spades. You know, the most important thing about healthcare is learn to lose. You can be a good loser like Harry Truman. He lost, but he kept on fighting. He went down and he kept saying, but the American people need this. And so he became a hero. Bill Clinton, when he lost, he walked away from the reform. Most people thought this reform was going to be very popular. That's what the Republicans feared. Their own memos tell us they feared that this was going to reignite middle-class connection with the Democrats. But when Clinton walked away, all he says in his autobiography is, I felt bad for Hillary. I probably should have tried welfare reform first. When he walked away from it, all the spin stayed with the opponents of the bill. So national health insurance disappeared for a decade, and so did the Democratic majorities. The last sad lesson for Barack Obama is, if you lose, keep fighting, because the legacy of the issue is very important to your party and the people who believe in your principles.
Mm. Well, I loved being in your class. You're terrific.
Oh, great, Kelly. Well, I like being on your show, so it's a mutual thing.
Do you have this much energy all day?
It's all coffee.
It's the answer, huh? It's coffee in the Daily Constitutional, right?
I think that's it. I got to keep up with my dog.
You're marvelous. Thank you so much for the book
for having
and being
me on the
with
show.
Us.
It was
I enjoyed
fun.
It. Thank you. Our guest this hour, the co-author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office, Professor James Marone, and it is co-authored by David Blumenthal. And David is a doctor, a professor of medicine and professor of health policy at Harvard Medical School. It's well worth the read. Who else has put together this history of how American presidents, what they've thought about health care and what they've enacted or not been able to enact during their administrations? This is the history from FDR up until Barack Obama. Yeah, that was interesting. Thanks to Jolema Noel and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks to John Treader, as always, for his on-air production here in our studios. A reminder that tomorrow at 7 o'clock, the president does deliver. We can't see the what's going on in the hallways in Congress, I guess, but we can see his major speech tomorrow on health care reform, and it will be broadcast here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio at 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening and calling, everybody. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.